I vowed to get an early start on preparing my taxes. No last minute for me ever again. So I will absolutely, positively get them started. Well, actually, I did get them started, but it was kind of late Saturday. Who's keeping score? Good morning. This is Central Standard. I'm Bill Anderson. The Cash Money crew is here today, and we're going to talk about that looming deadline. It's a week from now. More importantly, we're going to help you plan for next year. We're going to give you a really good start long before your taxes are due. And this plan will hopefully help us all lighten our burden while honestly paying our tax liability. We're joined by Sandy Weaver. She's back, president of Financial Security Advisors. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
Your taxes, I bet, were done a long time ago.
Well, they were started a long time ago. I filed last weekend.
Yes, and Alex Petrovic of Petrovic Financial Services.
Good morning,
sir. And I'm going to venture a guess that your taxes are already submitted as well.
I signed the documents. Tax person completed them for me, and they're being mailed today.
Also joining us is Julie Welch. Julie's with Mira Welch and Brown. Good morning. Nice to have you here.
Thank you very much.
Well, let's start with you. Before we start talking about planning, I know a lot of people are in my shoes. They wait until the last minute to file their taxes, right? You see that all the time.
All the time.
It's just human psychology.
Yes.
It's just human behavior. What risk do we run when we do that?
The risk that you run is that you miss deductions because you're not thinking about everything. And some of the common deductions that people miss would be like your personal property tax on your cars. That's a very common deduction people miss because they don't think about that being a deduction.
Uh-huh.
Charitable contributions is another important deduction that people miss, especially the non-cash items, you know, all the stuff you set out on the curb for somebody to come take away,
right,
like Goodwill or Salvation Army or whoever.
Mm-hmm.
All of those are charitable deductions, and you need to have good receipts and documentation, but that's a big overlooked deduction.
Before we move forward, I want to ask you about charitable deductions, gifts to Goodwill as an example. Let's say I give an old suit to Goodwill. I have no idea how to place a value on that for tax reporting purposes.
One way, we all now have access to the internet, and if you do some searches out there, there are some websites that will give you approximate thrift shop values for different items. And sometimes they'll have different categories. They'll say this is in excellent condition, this is in, you know, good condition, or this is in fair condition. But the main thing is to think about what somebody would buy it for in a thrift store.
Okay. Do you have any – are there any other obvious mistakes that people make by waiting until they have a week to meet the deadline?
Oh, they just don't know how to handle something. They get their 1099 form from the brokerage company, and they just don't know how to report their capital gains. And now the capital gains are reported so differently. They changed it starting last year. And so now the brokerage splits it out between what they have to report to the IRS and what they don't have to report to the IRS.
Mm-hmm.
And you be careful, because when they don't have to report it to the IRS, you still have cost basis that you get to use against that. You don't have to report all of that as gain. So I think that's a big problem that I see.
One thing I might add on that, if you use the file from your brokerage firm, they may not have the long-term, short-term capital gain correct, and you have to go back in and adjust that. And if you're rushing through your return at midnight to get that done, you might just fly right by that.
Okay.
And end up paying at a higher, you know, short-term tax rate instead of the longer-term cap gain tax
rate. Now, Sandy, is that related to cost basis? Or am I confused?
Well, yeah, it's in there.
Okay.
But it's purchase date and your cost basis. If the purchase date isn't correct from the brokerage firm's files, then, you know, you need to put in what's right.
Let me use myself as an example. I have the purchase date. I have the sale date of some mutual fund monies, but I have no idea what the cost basis is, and I have no way to find out. I don't believe anyway.
Your brokerage firm is supposed to have that, but ultimately you are, because we're right in the process of moving to that change. And so you really should go through your records on when you bought it and how many dividends reinvested you've had.
Okay.
Yeah. And if you bought directly, let's say you bought directly from a fund company, or if your broker had the mutual fund at the fund company record-wise, if you have enough time, they will send you the transcript of all your previous purchases and dividends and cap gains. But depending on the company, they may both charge you or take 2 or 3 weeks So this is this last-minute reporting piece. And I wanted to add one other thing on. Currently, the CPAs that are out there, they are giving you these tax organizers ahead of time, which are really helpful because you can compare what you did last year.
Mm-hmm.
So if you are using a CPA, I'm sure most of them are using these now. Either they're electronic or in paper form, and it really gives you a great idea of what you did last year. Reminds yourself of what you might miss this year based on some of the things you did last year. But so yay for CPAs!
Yeah, it's a good guide to use because that's the missing thing. The missing piece is you won't miss something if you say, "Hey, I had this last year."
Right.
You want to make sure you pick it up.
And I don't want to belabor a point, but I'm potentially hurting myself by not understanding what that cost basis is, correct?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, because if the brokerage firm doesn't have all of your cost basis records,
uh-huh.
they're going to say that it's much lower than it really is. That
okay.
means when you sell it, your gain is going to be much higher than it really is, which means that your tax is going to be much higher than it really should be.
Okay.
Yeah, the government's going to assume the worst if
okay.
you don't report it.
Yeah. Yeah, Julie.
And on mutual funds, usually you're reinvesting your dividends as you go, and most people miss adding that to their cost basis. They'll say, mm-hmm. okay, well, I put in $1,000, but they forget every year they were reinvesting the dividends and capital
right.
gains, and it was building up and up and up and up. So there right. may be a very small gain rather than a very large gain when somebody gets out right. of a mutual
okay.
fund.
Okay, okay.
And if you go back to each year's 1099, that will show that.
Okay, excellent. So in this day and age, 2013, CPAs versus software. Do you have any idea how many people have moved to software and kind of abandoned the use of a CPA?
Well, Julie's probably the definitive answer on this. But with working with clients, we see more and more people attempting, and then we see them go uh-huh. back and then go back to the CPA. I think they're a valuable resource. And if you have any complications at all, I think that they're well worth the money. And I'm
yeah.
not a CPA, but I've always used one.
Julie?
Yeah. Well, my experience is exactly what you said. A lot of people might try it because it's easy to do, and, mm-hmm. and let's try it, and it's going to ask me questions. But just remember, garbage in, garbage out.
Yeah.
Always, if you do it yourself, double-check it. I had somebody once who came in and said, I live in Kansas, but I work in Missouri, and I'm not sure I did that state tax return correctly. Would you mind looking at it?
Yeah.
And I said, sure, I'll look at it. And I looked at it, and I said, well, if you did it correctly, you'd have saved $13. But let me ask you another question. How did you get this number on line 7, which is wages? And he said, well, that's off my W-2. I said, great. Do you just work one job? Yes. Does your spouse work? No. I said, well, if you let me fix that number, then you'll get a $3,000 refund. So he just hadn't checked the numbers, and his was a pretty basic return.
Uh-huh. That's Julie Welch, CPA. She's with the CPF Financial Planning Group. Alex Petrovic is here. He owns Petrovic Financial Services, and Sandy Weaver joins us this morning. She's a certified financial planner and owner of Financial Security Advisors. Kansas City, we'd like to invite you to join this conversation. 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888. Share your tax planning tips, or maybe you have a horror story to share about a filing error or something related to meeting the April 15th obligation, 235-2888. So I guess this is a good point at which we should start talking about long-term planning. I'm going to start with you, Sandy. Where do I begin? Because historically speaking, this represents April 8th, a fairly early start for me, and I'm sure I'm not alone. It's one of those things we like to put off.
Okay, I'll start with, from a financial planning aspect, you probably have, I'm guessing, stocks, bonds, mutual funds perhaps, and you mm-hmm. have a choice of accounts. You can own those in your pension plan, your 403B or 401K. You might have an IRA where you could own those, and you also then might have a brokerage account where you could own those. Well, you sort of want to take a look at those and decide, which do I want to own in which account? Because whatever you own in your pension or your IRA, you don't pay tax on that
mm-hmm.
if it throws off a lot of taxable income. If you own it in your taxable account, say perhaps that you have joint with your wife, that you are going to pay tax on. So if you have a bond fund, take a look at that 1099 and see how much of the dividends coming off your bond fund were qualified versus non-qualified.
Okay.
And the difference to you, why you care, is because if it's qualified, it gets taxed at 15%. if it's not qualified, you're going to pay perhaps 25% or higher on it, mm-hmm. assuming that you're in the 25% bracket or higher. And so that then matters. If you have a bond fund throwing off a lot of non-qualified income, look at that 1099, then try to own that in your pension plan or in your IRA.
I see. Alex, any thoughts?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first off, to make any real difference in investment income, you know, that planning needs to be done early in the year, because if you make those changes in December in terms of where your assets are located or whether you own tax-free bonds or deferred annuities or stocks that, you know, cap gains are 15% maybe for most people or lower possibly, you need to get that started at the beginning of the year, because it's not going to make much difference to you tax-wise if you wait till late in the year.
Mm-hmm.
So those are things you can't just wait December, you know, to make a difference.
Follow-up, you mentioned annuity. I've heard of people putting what is already a tax-sheltered product, an annuity, into their retirement accounts.
Right.
I don't – what's the point of that?
Well, I agree. I'm not – that's an issue for me as well, although the newer annuities, they're not really focusing as much on the tax-deferred nature as these – guaranteed income streams.
Okay.
So they've kind of changed their stripes over the years. And so it's possible that they would work in retirement accounts because of some of these guaranteed income streams for retired people. But I think it's a real good point, and you're right on, Bill. I think you're maybe a candidate for this business.
Well, let's go. Let's find out. We'll talk to Barbara. She's calling from Prairie Village. Good morning. You're on the air, Barbara.
Good morning. What I wanted to talk about was married filing jointly versus married filing separately. I run an AARP tax aid site, and we do tax preparation for seniors and lower income people. And one of the more common errors is couples that come in, or they come in separately and file separately because they've heard a rumor that they're going to get a bigger refund. And we've had some huge refunds and amendments done for people that have been filing improperly, or for non-native speakers of English who think if they're not living with their spouse that they cannot file married filing jointly.
Good question.
Yeah.
Julie?
Married filing separately, the times that it's beneficial is usually when one spouse has really high income and the other spouse has lower income but a lot of maybe medical expenses. In order to be able to deduct medical expenses, you can only deduct them if they're over, for last year it was over 7.5% of your adjusted gross income. So you had to have pretty low income to get that. Most of the times it works out better to file jointly. And if you first file jointly, you can't go back and change your mind and file separately, but you can go the other way. So if you filed separately in the past because you thought it might be better, look at it to consider changing to married filing jointly. But most of the times it works out better to file jointly. Our software will actually go through and do a calculation to say how much better it is to file jointly. And most of the times it's very significant. And sometimes it's not very significant. It's $500 better to file jointly. But if you file separately, now remember you're filing two returns. Mm-hmm. You know, and if you're using a tax preparer, you're paying for two returns. And if you're doing it on your own, you're probably having to pay for two electronic files and all of that. So it's a little more complicated if you have to file separately.
Does that help, Barbara? I guess we've lost Barbara, but I'm going to assume it does. 235-2888 puts you on the air with us. This is Central Standard. I'm Bill Anderson, and you're listening to KCUR. Just a note, a programming note, you'll have a front row seat at 11 o'clock. Up to Date is doing a remote broadcast out at the K this afternoon. At 11 o'clock with a game time of about 3:10, I believe. Alex, I want to digress just a little bit. You've got a pretty exciting experience coming your way this afternoon at the K. Tell us about it. Share that with our audience.
Well, I'm fortunate to have I'm Alex number two. My father is going to sit in the Buck O'Neill seat today with former mayor and judge Charles Wheeler in recognition of really the 67 bond or 68 bond package that allotted about $50 million to build the Truman Sports Complex.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty proud of my dad. 90 years old.
That's great.
Drive him out there.
Yeah.
And he was actually the inspiration by naming it the Truman Sports Complex, because he was a big admirer of Harry Truman.
Yeah, that's got to be really – you must be one proud
really happy.
Son.
Yeah, I don't get to sit that close to
– Well, you'll be in the cheap seats, right?
We're in the Buccaneer. We're down there right on
you'll
the,
be with them.
Yeah.
Okay, good for you.
Well, it came with two spare tickets as chauffeurs.
Dan, I'll be glad to make sure you get out there okay.
Thank you.
Let's get back on task here. Kansas City, we'd like to hear – you know, maybe you've made just an incredible mistake doing taxes by yourself in the past. Well, we've got some professional advice here, and we're talking right now about long-term planning. And what are some of the – Sandy, I'll start with you. What are some of the updates in the law for 2013 or Julie?
Oh, well, some of the updates, and Sandy, you can talk about like IRAs and things if there's any changes there. But there's some new taxes out there for the higher income people that they really have to be careful of. If you make too much money, whatever too much money is, then you're going to have higher taxes. Part of these were put into law as a result of the Pension Protection Act, which is the health care reform.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to be for Medicare. They call it a Medicare surtax. So it's really not an income tax because your income taxes didn't go up. It's this Medicare surtax. But for people who have earned income, that's wages or a sole proprietorship or something like that, they're going to pay an extra 0.9% on their income if they're over the amount. And for the people who have unearned income, like investment income, that's what a lot of people we might be talking about here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if your income is over the threshold, you're going to pay an additional 3.8%.
Okay.
So Sandy mentioned the 15% dividend tax rate. And in 2013, the capital gains rate and the dividend rate's gone up to 20%. Okay, well, now add 3.8% on top of that. So it's really 23.8 plus your state tax, which for Kansas and Missouri is about 5 or 6%.
Right. Now, those that Julie are talking about are if you're adjusted gross income, you're modified, or over $250,000 if you're filing joint, $200,000 if you're filing single.
Okay. All right. So. Now, I was reading an article from KHI News Service, and here's a quote from Meg Sutton. She's a senior advisor for tax and healthcare services at H&R Block. And she says the 2010 federal health reform law is the biggest tax code change in the past 20 years. Julie, I guess this is a question for you. You're nodding your head in agreement, first of all. But she says it breaks down along two lines: penalties for not having health insurance and subsidies that will be available to low and modest income families. Now, this isn't so much a factor now, but in 2014, it becomes really critically important for us to have some understanding of that new tax law.
Yeah, and that's not even what I'm going to call an income tax. It's a penalty for not having health insurance.
Uh-huh.
It's trying to assure that everybody has health insurance. And if you don't pay for health insurance, you'll pay a penalty. And the first year, the penalty is going to be fairly small. And a lot of people will probably choose to pay that penalty rather than have health insurance because it's really low. The lower your income is, the lower it is. But as the years progress and we get, you know, closer and closer to full implementation of the bill, it's going to be very expensive to pay that penalty.
So what should I do now? Is there anything I can do at this point in time to plan ahead?
Well, you can try to lower your income then in 2013,
okay,
which means you can try to defer income over into 14. Don't take receipt of some income. The other thing you can do, though, is try to accelerate deductions into 2013 to drive that income lower. So,
okay.
For example, the property tax, if you pay it in January, pay it in December at the end of this year. Do things like that. Bunch your expenses up.
Yeah. Julie, anything to add?
Yeah. And the other thing to watch is long-term, since we're talking about long-term planning, is, you know, really you have to look and see what the law is going to be in 2014, 2015, 2016, because you may not want to do some of the shifting if the penalty would be worse the next year.
Right.
You might want to actually keep the expenses in the year that they should be.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really a tough play. It's the same. It's really similar to the people who are getting college money, you know, trying to get college money. How do I get my tax return so it doesn't have a whole lot of income on it so I qualify for more of the financial aid?
Right.
You know, and then I have to be careful because it's not just the first year that I apply for financial aid. It's the next 4 years that I'm applying for financial aid.
Yes. Let's go to the phones, and Edwin is calling us from Kansas City, Missouri. Hey, Edwin.
Hello. Yes, I'm here.
Go ahead, sir.
Yes, I received my tax statements from my brokerages, and then I went ahead and filed my taxes. And then after I did that, and I did this online, I filed them online. And after I did that, I received a second updated brokerage statement from one of my brokerages. And they changed. The primary change was is that one security, and it wasn't that much money invested in it, but for the dividends that was paid, initially the first statement I got showed it as all non-qualified dividends. And then the second statement shows a small amount of qualified dividends, and the rest of it is denoted as non-dividend distribution, which takes away that amount is not even it may be reported, but it's not taxable for that year until actually I sell it or whatever. And would it be necessary to refile again? Because in actuality, I look at it as if it came out favorable for me as far as if I owe taxes, that it would actually lessen the amount of tax I would owe if I was to refile again.
Hmm. Well, you're getting some nods in the studio here.
Yes.
First of all, let me say, we always tell our clients, get your tax returns ready, but don't file till late.
Okay.
Just because a corrected 1099 can come down the pike, and yeah, you do have to file an amendment.
When you say late, what, the 14th, the morning of the 15th?
Well, not that late.
You're giving me some encouragement here.
Yeah, there's an advantage to your method. Well, late, I don't know how late they can issue corrected 99s, but, you know, we've seen them late in the month of March in some years. So I would, you know, get them ready early, but file late. Otherwise, you're into the amended tax return. And I'll hand it over to Julie, but.
Hey, yeah. Go ahead, Julie.
Yeah, and some of these changes, like you mentioned, some of the changes are so small. They change something from non-qualified to qualified dividend. And when that happens, you know, that just means you might have a better tax rate on it. But if they change it to the non-taxable dividend or return of capital dividend, then it's not taxable at all. And depending on the dollar amount, yes, you should file an amended to get a refund. And the other way around, if they report more income for some reason, then you should file an amended, or there's a good chance you'll get an IRS notice saying, hey, you didn't report this properly.
In this one, though, he says he's not paying tax, so maybe the IRS will just bounce it because it's a 1099 and report it to them, but maybe they'll just bounce it and he won't pay again, so maybe he could let it slide.
Yeah. If it's a refund, you're not required to file. I mean, if you've overpaid your tax, you're not required to file an amended return to get a refund back. But But you can't adjust for it the next year and say, oh, gosh, I overreported last year, so let me underreport this year.
Does that help, Alex?
Yeah, no, I agree with what they're saying. I just wanted to add to these amended 1099s that are coming out and being more problematic every year. And there a particular mutual fund that we used I thought was one of the culprits because every year, and a lot of people, I mean, really are upset about these amended for good reasons. So I contacted our back office, and they sent me a report to see in the mutual fund industry at our firm, which is a large firm nationally, and it was, I mean, thousands of them, which we were going to try to say, okay, if these guys are the ones that are causing this every year, then we're going to boot them. We're not going to use them because our clients are yelling at us, you know. Turned out that we'd have to, you know, pretty much eliminate half the recognized mutual funds in the industry, and it's because they're the ones that report these amended income differences. So, as Sandy said earlier, you know, prepare early, but don't, you know, in the statements, the 1099s are very clear. Probably people don't read them on the front. They say, you know, there could be another one coming. We're not saying this is the last one.
Yeah.
And so this is a problem, you know, maybe in the future, maybe we'll get a May 1st deadline instead of an April 15th.
Are they, as mutual fund companies, what's up here? Are they falling down on the job?
Well, I think it's a combination because it depends on the bond could be restated. And so they're delaying themselves to be sure so they don't have to file an amended one as well. But there's a lot more derivatives being used in mutual funds. So there's a lot more complexity in the type of investments that are in the funds, which are causing these issues.
But Julie?
It's kind of a chain reaction because, you know, if the mutual fund is investing in other companies, they have to find out how that company is reporting something, whether it's a dividend or a non-taxable return of capital or something before they can report it. But that other company doesn't have to report it till January 31st to this company. Well, this company was supposed to do a reporting by January the 31st. So they made their reporting, and then they get it corrected, you know, or get the real numbers. And so then they have to file a corrected. So it's kind of a chain reaction just because you're not investing just in one company. And even when you invest in one company, that company, if it doesn't have this technical term called earnings and profits, when it pays out money, it's just returning capital. It's not giving you a taxable dividend.
Okay.
So if you have that situation going on, they may not know that until I've had corrected 1099s all the way up through September. Not very frequently, but that can happen because, you know, it takes a long time to get that other tax return prepared.
We're going to take a short break. You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Bill Anderson. And with us is Sandy Weaver, Alex Petrovic, and Julie Welch. We're talking tax planning and maybe even some last-minute tips. We'd love to hear from you. 235-2888. That's 235-2888. Feel free to message us on our Facebook page. It's the Cash Money Crew on KCUR. And we're back. I'm Bill Anderson. This is Central Standard, Kansas City. We're talking about taxes, and we're talking about tax planning, things you can do to kind of position yourself to get what you have coming, to get to maximize your money. After all, it is your money, and you don't want to pay any more than you have to based on tax law. Kansas City, we want you to join this conversation. We invite you to phone 235-2888. Share your tax planning tips. Share your stories. You might even have a horror story to share. I've got a few that I'll probably reserve for another time. Let's get back on track. And before we do, let me introduce our crew. We've got Julie Welch, CPA with the CPF Financial Planning Group. Alex Petrovic, owner of Petrovic Financial Services, looking really good in your Royals blue T-shirt
Thank you. This morning.
And Sandy Weaver. Sandy's a certified financial planner, owner of Financial Security Advisors. Sandy, let's start with you. Let's go back to this long-term planning so that we can maximize our return.
Okay, good. I have a couple. Mutual funds have their year end on October 31st. So one thing we always look at in November is if you have mutual funds in a taxable account, let's go again to that one you and your wife own. Let's say you have a stock mutual fund in there.
Mm-hmm.
And let's say if you sold that you would have a capital gain of, say, $3,000. But let's say this year that mutual fund did really, really well, and it's going to distribute. If you look at their website or call them up, you can find out that it's going to distribute to you, say, $5,000. So what would you rather do? Would you rather keep that mutual fund in your account and take a distribution of $5,000, or do you want to sell it and pay a capital gains tax of $3,000?
Yeah, well,
obviously, the cheaper route is the latter route. So that's something that's a question and a quick math thing you can do with everything you own in that taxable account.
Okay.
So that'd be checking those year-end distributions that you can do.
So that would be November.
Yeah.
Yeah,
you can do that in November.
Uh-huh.
Right. Second thing you can do is give appreciated securities. Let's say that you own a stock and you've owned it for quite some time and you have normally, let's say, you give a couple $1,000 to your church or some religious organization. You can instead give them that stock that you own. And let's say that, again, it's worth $2,000. You'll give them the same $2,000, but it will be in the form of stock. Let's say that your stock, the cost basis is $700. So that would be $1,300. When your church sells it, they don't pay capital gains tax.
Okay.
If you sold it, you would give them the $2,000, then turn around at year end and pay a capital gains tax.
Do I have?
Give them the
stock. Excuse me.
Oh, sorry.
Do I have any tax liability whatsoever for donating that to a charitable cause?
No, you get a deduction for the charitable.
It's a deduction.
Right.
So let's talk deduction versus credit.
Okay.
Explain.
On a deduction, that reduces the taxable income that you have, and then after that, it's used to calculate your taxes due.
Mm-hmm.
The beauty of tax credits, let's say your taxes due is $10,000. If you have a tax credit of $1,000, that's $9,000 that you end up paying. Tax credits are one for one. Tax deductions are farther upstream from that. They de- they go into the calculation determining the tax credit. Tax credits are always worth their weight in gold and are far more valuable than a deduction.
Right, yeah. Julie, you're nodding your head in agreement.
Absolutely. Yeah. Deductions are always better than credits. I mean, I'm sorry, I said that backwards, just to see if everybody was listening here. Credits are always better than deductions.
I caught that.
Yeah. And there's some special credits that are even available on the states. Like Missouri has some neighborhood assistance program credits and youth opportunity credits. And what happens is these organizations apply to the state of Missouri and they get these credits assigned to them. And then if a person or a business donates money to this organization, you get to take your normal deduction for donating the money, and then they give you this credit, and many times it's a 50% credit. So if you give $1,000, you get to deduct the $1,000 and save, if your income tax rate is 25% and another 6% stays, so you save about 31%, save about $300 that way, and then you get a credit for 50% of what you gave. So again, if it was $1,000, you get a credit of $500. So effectively, you've saved $800. And you gave $1,000, so it only cost you $200 to give that $1,000. It's a heck of a deal.
Yes, Kansas has it too. Most of those are community service credits. They also have the individual development account. They do make you reverse the deduction on the federal side, but it's still worth your weight in gold on that.
Sergio writes, "I recently opened up a photography studio. I'm a very small business. Are there any tips or suggestions on what's the best way to proceed with my business tax filings?" Julie, that's probably in your camp.
Record keeping. That's what I'm going to say for most small businesses. That is why they pay more tax than they need to, is because they don't do good record keeping. Use a program that tracks finances like Quicken or Money or Xero, I guess it's called. There's a lot of programs out there that will actually track, just like a checkbook, but it'll account everything for you, so you won't be missing your deductions. Many small business people miss the deduction for the use of their car. You know, they get to take their mileage expense, or they can calculate the actual expenses, whichever works to their benefit. Some small business owners, if they run the business out of their house, can have a home office deduction. Okay, that type of business, again, you have to have your expenses accumulated. In that case, you've got utilities on the house and, you know, insurance and things that you normally don't get to deduct. But again, just the normal day-to-day expenses, just make sure you don't miss something. You go to the store and you pay cash for something. You're not tracking
right.
it. You really have to track everything.
Jim has a question about long-term care insurance. You're on the air, Jim.
I am. Hey, thank you for the service. I appreciate this. Hey, quickly, tax benefits. Long-term care insurance, very, very expensive. What are the tax benefits, if any, to purchasing long-term care? And then second of all, back to the Healthcare Affordability Act, there's something I've heard called Cadillac plans. If your premium or if your business that you work for owns offers a Cadillac plan, that there's a tax consequence to that. So if you could answer those two questions, I'd appreciate it.
Sandy, why don't you take the first question about long-term care insurance?
Okay, I'm going to have to ask Julie to double-check me. I think they can deduct the premiums in the medical expense bucket on itemized Schedule A, but it's subject to 7.5%. And actually, in 2013, that goes to 10%
okay.
of AGI.
Julie?
And there is a limitation on that based on your age with the long-term care insurance. So depending on how old you are, they might limit how much you get to deduct. Because some of the long-term care insurance are, you know, what they call a 10-pay plan, where you pay over 10 years. Well, you're paying a lot of money, and you're going to be over that dollar amount for that age bracket.
Okay.
The other nice thing is I believe both Missouri and Kansas have a special deduction for long-term care insurance, and that's an overlooked deduction because it's just a little line on the form. But if you get it in there, you're going to save that deduction on the state taxes.
And Jim was curious about the Cadillac health plans.
Cadillac health plans, I'll tell you the little bit that I know about them. And again, usually it applies to the employer. It's going to be an extra tax or consequence to the employer by offering too good of a plan. And you know, we're going to have to kind of see what happens. I think things are going to change before we get to 2017 a lot. They've changed already. I think we're going to continue to see changes there. At this point, a lot of people that I've talked to are not real concerned about the Cadillac plans because the insurance companies are taking care of it to make sure that they're structured properly.
Okay.
I don't think it's a tax on the individuals themselves, but they may lose some benefits because the company may not offer as good a plan anymore.
What else can I do here in 2013, starting today, to help me prepare for 2014, Alex?
Well, the American Taxpayer Relief Act of 2012, which they passed, you know, I think on January 1st of 2013, did extend for another year on qualified charitable distributions. And those are when you take money out of your IRA, where you're so it's for people over 70 and a half. So they can make these distributions. If they don't need the cash, they can give them to charities and alleviate the income tax on that. And just a really quick example, I have a client that owns a lot of Dell stock to the tune of close to $200,000 in capital gains. Well, as we know, Dell is thinking about taking the company private, so it won't be avoid the capital gains because they'll pay cash. So we were talking to his CPA to say, what can we do for him? It's almost certain this is going to happen. So one area would be the qualified, he's over 70 and a half, to bring down his adjusted gross income. So the point is if you're thinking actively about what you own and where it's positioned, this was not in an IRA, it's a taxable account, and you have the time to think about it. But, you know, if you're doing it on your own, you got to be doing it, you know, you got to be doing it wisely. If you're working with a planner and a CPA, those are things that you can get ahead of. And I think this is the last year, unless they change the tax code, for the charitable, qualified charitable distributions. Now, I had one question for Julie, though. Is there a limit on how much that you can give away through the IRA?
There is. It's $100,000. You have to be 70 and a half or older. And you can give $100,000, and both spouses could do it. So both spouses could give $100,000 away.
So if it's on a joint account or a trust, what if it's a joint trust account or something?
It has to come from your IRA, so those are separate accounts.
Oh, I'm sorry, right.
Yeah.
IRA, right.
Yeah, so each spouse would have to have at least that much.
Right.
So that's what the limitation is. And where I see that deduction or that benefit really helpful is somebody who doesn't itemize deductions. So they don't have state taxes, perhaps, or, you know, for some reason they just take the standard deduction. So the charitable deduction doesn't help them any because they're already getting the standard deduction. So it keeps that amount from being in their income, and they don't get the deduction anyway. So it's beneficial that way. Or Sandy and I were talking before the show, sometimes if somebody has, they're losing a lot of deductions because of medical or miscellaneous deductions.
Yeah, they can take it lower. But it's almost a wash in a lot of cases. It nets to nothing.
Let's go back to the phones in 2 North Kansas City, and Mike joins us.
You know, you guys were answering my question because it was about giving the minimum distribution in my IRA directly to charity. And they just answered it.
Okay.
Now, I'd like to extend the question, though. And my question is, if you've got a... If you have a donor-directed charitable organization, if you form a donor-directed fund in something like Vanguard, can I take the $100,000 and give it to my donor-directed fund, or is there a limitation that says I can't do that?
That's an excellent question. I would have to say I have to double-check that to be certain. I'm not positive on that. I kind of think it applies, but
he's not talking an IRA. He's talking like a donor advised fund. It's a taxable,
right?
Coming out of a taxable account, not out of an IRA, I believe. Correct?
Yeah, but
I'm trying to give the IRA money as a charitable contribution, but instead of giving it to the United Way, I want to give it to my donor directed fund. So I can decide over time which charities we want to make the donations to.
Yeah, it's for putting money into a donor advised fund, it's a good deduction. I just don't know if it works with the qualified charitable deduction. The other good thing that you mentioned there would be to watch for appreciated stock that Sandy talked about earlier. There are limitations when you have a donor advised fund. You know, normally if you give away charitable contributions, you can deduct them. However, if they're more than half of your income, then you can't deduct it that year. You have a 5-year period to carry it over. So if you give away too much money, and then if you donate appreciated stock, then sometimes there's other limitations that pulls that 50% down. Most people don't run into that limitation, but you know, if you're giving away a significant amount, you might run into the limitation.
Yeah. Okay, and I'd like to chime in on those tax credits to various charitable organizations around the state of Missouri and the state of Kansas. To me, that's almost nonprofit corporate welfare. And if it's a charitable organization, everybody ought to get the same deduction. And that business of picking out this one and that one for a credit is just gives me a headache, and it leads to all the things about influence and influence peddling at Jeff City that we find so abhorrent with our corporations. I think it's crazy for our not-for-profit.
You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. I'm your host, Bill Anderson. Sandy Weaver is here. Alex Petrovic is here. So is Julie Welch. And we invite your phone calls and we invite your email. Maybe you'd like to make a post on Facebook. Mike writes us from Overland Park. While recently helping my parents with their return, I noticed my father was filing the sale of stocks and mutual funds sold in his trust. I'm not even sure what kind of trust he had set up, but he was doing so under his regular 1040 tax return. Question, when you sell securities within a trust, don't you get a more favorable tax rate if you file a trust tax return?
He's probably talking about a revocable trust, and the tax ID is his dad's Social Security, so his dad's doing it correctly.
Okay.
And trust, to the second question is, no, trusts do not have a better tax rate schedule than individuals. He's doing it right.
Which leads to the age-old question. Will we ever simplify the tax code? It won't happen, will it?
No.
There are too many special interests.
Yeah.
What is it? Is that it?
Yeah, it's a political process.
Yeah.
The previous caller hit it on the head, whether you're on the right side of the street for how they, you know, legislate tax code, but it's clearly been used for, you know, social reasons, political reasons, economic reasons, corporate. It's who gets the most votes.
Okay. I've heard that being meticulous and prepared, organized, helps people in the event that they get audited. Now, what are some of these things we should be doing to make the audit process as smooth as possible in that like unlikely event? Julie?
Documentation. Again, I'll bring that up again. You have to have records. If you don't have records for a deduction, you're not going to get the deduction.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the big ones that people right now have that I'm really concerned about is the charitable deduction, because the organization has to give you a receipt. Okay, if you make a charitable contribution and it's $250 or more, you must have a receipt from the organization, whether it's cash, check, or whatever. You have to have a receipt. And it can't just be a receipt that says, thank you for your donation. It has to say, thank you for your donation. You received no goods or services in exchange for this donation. And I'm telling everybody, that includes if you donate the used clothes and household items to the people who come and pick them up off your doorstep.
Mm-hmm.
That little tag that's hanging there needs to say no goods or services were received in exchange for your donation. There was a recent tax court case. A guy gave $22,000 to his church, and he got audited and gave the auditor the receipt. It said, you know, thank you for your donation, a total $22,000, and the auditor said, well, this receipt's no good. It doesn't have that wording on it. So he disallowed it. And the guy said, well, I'm going to court. And meanwhile, he went back to the church and said, can you give me a receipt that's got that wording on it? And the church says, sure, here you go. So he goes into court and he hands the judge that receipt. And the judge looks at it and says, well, this would be a great receipt, and this would work. However, you didn't have it when you filed your tax return. The law says you must have it when you file your tax return.
Ouch.
So we're sorry. You know, we know you gave the money. We're sorry, but no deduction.
Wow.
So it's an ouch. So yeah. I'm advising everybody to really watch those receipts. But documentation is the big thing on when you get audited for whatever it is, whether it's mileage expenses, you have to be able to prove somehow how far you drove and when you drove it. For even office supplies, you know, you should have a listing or, you know, the receipts how much you bought.
Yeah.
I found this interesting. Last week I was listening to Marketplace, and Stephen Dubner, who's the host of Freakonomics Radio, says the IRS misses some 17% of the taxpaying or potentially taxpaying public. And he had a report on, and he noted that in Britain, they actually send out notes to taxpayers. And I'm assuming it's the delinquent taxpayers. And they had responses from like 9 out of 10 people that they contacted with this cute little note. I don't know if it's handwritten or not, but I found that psychology pretty fascinating. Have you ever heard of anything like that?
No.
Yeah, that's crazy. And here's another thought about compliance. And this was part of Stephen Dubner's report. Why not allow people to select where a certain percentage of their tax dollar goes? Alex, you think that would work?
Nope.
Why not?
because the government has certain places that they already know where they want it to go. I mean, it's a nice idea. I just don't see it working. It's just such a political process. And, I mean, somebody else might disagree. The only thing you really get to choose on your tax return is if you want to give to a presidential election.
Oh. Yeah.
But I'll entertain other thoughts.
Public radio. Let's go to Lenexa. Alex joins us. Hey, Alex.
Hey, how you doing?
Doing well, thank you.
Three quick questions. If you pay health insurance out of pocket yourself, is that tax deductible, or can you get some type of credit or tax deduction? Second question is, if you pay through your job health insurance, and I know that's pre-tax, is that reducing your income? And my last question is, are church tithings, not so much a contribution, but are church tithings tax deductible? And I'll take my answer off the phone.
Okay, thank you, sir.
The church tithing is tax deductible.
Yeah.
The health insurance is if you pay it with your own dollars, not pre-tax dollars, but after-tax dollars, it goes into your medical expenses. If you're self-employed, there's a special deduction for that, what they call above-the-line deduction. But if you're not self-employed, you work at a company, that is a medical deduction, but you have to itemize deductions, and it has to exceed, starting this year, 10% of your adjusted gross income, yeah. Another exception unless you're 65 or over. And then if it's paid with pre-tax dollars through your employer, it's already been deducted. Your income is already reduced, so you don't get to reduce it again. But that is an excellent benefit for employers to provide because it is a tax-free. It reduces your income.
Did you have something to add
to
that, Alex?
The tax specialist over here, Julie, I had a personal question for her. My CPA allows me to take S-Corp, allows me to take a deduction for the Kansas City earnings tax for the days that I am not working in Kansas City. So he says, please. I think I had 3 weeks last year that I didn't work in Kansas City, and I was able to get the rebate on the tax on that. Is that only for self-employed people, or is that for anybody?
No, it's for anybody who receives a W-2. If you're working in Kansas City but you don't live in Kansas City, so you have to live outside of Kansas City,
right?
And you work in Kansas City but you travel.
Mm-hmm.
You can get a refund for the days you work outside the city. It is a huge overlooked item.
Yeah, exactly. So it's another item.
That's an excellent one.
Steve has a question from Overland Park. Steve, it's going to have to be kind of quick.
Okay. It's a state income tax question. My wife and I live in Overland Park, and I work for a company. She's being transferred to Tennessee, which is a zero state income tax state, and we're moving down there. I work for a company out of Chicago. They take out my state income tax for the state of Kansas. So next year, not this year, since my new residence is actually going to be the state of Tennessee, but I am going to be coming up to Kansas City about once a month and calling on my customers still, my company will no longer take out state income tax because I live in Tennessee. Will I have to file a return for Kansas or Missouri?
Who wants to field that question?
It depends on the level of activity that you have. If you're doing work in Kansas or Missouri, they're usually looking for an income tax return. Usually a one-day stay isn't going to do anything unless you're a football player playing at the stadium. They will show up with their hand out waiting for the Kansas City earnings tax and the Missouri tax because it's a lot of money.
Sandy, did you have something to add to that?
No, I did not.
Yeah, and I'm assuming that answered your question, Steve?
Well, what if I only fly up once a day, once a month, and I'm physically consummating a sale then, what about the other 19 days where I do it by phone from the state of Tennessee?
Well, if you're getting the W-2 from your company's supposed to be tracking where you're doing the work. So they have to be tracking that. And if they feel that you're doing business in the state, then they should be, you know, looking at that as Missouri or Kansas wages.
Quickly, let's go around the table. Is there anything that we left off as we look at long-term planning here? And Sandy, I have a feeling you've got one or two items.
I do. One I've been trying to get in
okay.
here.
Okay.
If you have an adult child who's getting married this next year, or perhaps a child who is paying college tuition, you might think about gifting them stock or a mutual fund where you have a big capital gain and give it over to them in their brokerage account, have them sell it there. Their marginal tax bracket is usually 15% or lower, so they won't have to pay capital gains at all.
Okay. Anything else? Anyone?
Smart Money Month.
Smart Money Month. Tell us a little bit. You've got 20 seconds, Alex. Well,
SmartMoneyMonthKC.org. How's that?
I said 20 seconds.
I'll say it again. SmartMoneyKC.org.
Don't forget to file your tax return and do your IRA contributions before April 15th.
That's good advice, Julie Welch with Mira Welch and Brown. Alex Petrovic, always nice to see you, sir.
Thank you.
And Sandy Weaver, President of Financial Security Advisors. Nice to have you in the studio this morning.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, good job. Good job, all three.
Thank you, Bill.
Thanks for joining us. You can hear this conversation again, subscribe to our podcast, or access any of our previous shows from the Central Standard page of KCUR.org. And make sure you tune in tomorrow for Nature in the City. Our show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Suzanne Hogan. Up to Date is next, a live broadcast from Kauffman Stadium. I'm Bill Anderson. This is Central Standard.